Join me. You may be able to help solve a mystery.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome to another episode of You Solved a Mystery, a podcast where we delve into solved segments of the iconic Unsolved Mysteries and reveal the final chapter. I'm Athena.
And I'm Chandra. And if we sound exactly the same, it's because we're twins. Not much we can do about it.
I don't have anything interesting to add today.
Should we just leave the closet?
No, I have a story. So in addition to the 13 kittens living in my bedroom, we also have a four-month-old puppy we're fostering that Chandra found in the street. Hopefully she won't scratch at my bedroom door too much. But once again, in a house just jam-packed with foster animals.
Bear with us.
Please. So the story I have today, I was wrong. Carlucci was not the last story from original special number 7. This, I think, is.
So, no promises this time.
I can't promise anything. So this story is from original special number 7, and it has, as with Carlucci, been reworked into season 1, episode 3 on YouTube. It was, of course, hosted by Robert Stack, and originally aired May 18th, 1988. This particular case, when I first started researching it, I was like, this is wild, and I found it a little bit funny. But then, as I continued researching it, it threw me right through a loop, and it kind of called me out on some hypocrisy I wasn't checking myself on, so it's going to be an interesting one. And it is quite the story.
I'm a little intimidated about what I just got myself in for.
In 1986, Diane Broadbeck was a quiet, church-going woman living in Willsbury, Pennsylvania. She was 43 years old and had two daughters with her husband, Chester. On April 5th, 1986, Diane Broadbeck disappeared. A month later, her car was found in a motel parking lot 30 minutes from her home. Her overnight bag was still in the trunk. The same day Diane vanished, convicted murderer John Yount escaped from prison. Earlier that day, Diane had been seen driving along a country road a half a mile from the prison. Diane was the type of woman to keep busy. She had been a bank manager before becoming a stay-at-home mom. She had an interest in psychology, and she was active in her church, and she volunteered writing letters to prison inmates who didn't have any friends or family. One of her correspondents was John Yount. So detectives had reason to believe that she was with Yount, but authorities wondered, was she kidnapped, or was she an accomplice? At the time of the broadcast, they had been missing for 2 years. Diane's mother, Nadine Warner, was interviewed for Unsolved Mysteries and said that she didn't think Diane would deliberately help a murderer escape. Diane's husband, Chester, explained that he believed she did so, but only because she was, quote, under pressure. Before his incarceration, John Yount had been a popular math teacher. He was a 1958 Penn State graduate with a master's degree in math education. He was married and had children. But on April 20th, 1966, he offered a ride to a pupil walking home from school named Pamela Sue Reimer. That afternoon, the 18-year-old high school student's books were discovered along a country road. Not far into the woods, they found her body. She had been beaten, her throat cut, and they suspected she had been sexually assaulted. Pamela was an honor student. She rode horses, played the clarinet in the school band, and had a scholarship to Pennsylvania State University. Yount turned himself in the next day and confessed to the murder, but denied sexually assaulting her. Except for a shoe beneath her and a stocking around her neck, her body was fully clothed. Yount told the police he was looking for property in the area to purchase when he saw Pamela and offered her a ride. He testified that he'd made an innocent comment, but intent and impact are not the same, and Pamela took it as an advance. She started to get out of the car, saying she was going to tell the authorities. He said he vaguely recalled hitting her with a wrench, but didn't remember stabbing her with his pocket knife. Pamela was buried in her prom dress, and classmates laid their graduation tassels on her grave. Yount was convicted of first-degree murder and rape and sentenced to life in prison.
I can't say that I buy in too much to the whole I don't remember doing it, like, blackout defense. Mm-hmm. I'm not too sure about that right there.
There's something really weird about someone who didn't have a violent history suddenly murdering someone. Something real sketchy about that. After the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that his Miranda rights had been violated, Yount was actually granted a second trial in 1969. Yount argued that he should have been convicted of second-degree murder, which would mean the murder was not premeditated. At the time, second-degree murder came with a 10 to 20-year sentence. However, at his second trial, 77% of the jury pool in the small, rural Pennsylvania community he was part of were familiar with the case and had already formed an opinion against him, and the judge refused to move the trial. In selection, 8 out of the 14 jurors admitted they already thought he was guilty and were kept on the jury anyway. He was again sentenced with first-degree murder, but not rape. The autopsy didn't actually find any proof of sexual assault. In 1985, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit ruled that he had not had access to an unbiased jury and should receive a third trial, but the Supreme Court reversed the Third Circuit's decision, and a third trial was denied.
I'm having complicated feelings because obviously for Pamela's family, it doesn't matter if it was first or second degree murder, and he has admitted to being a murderer, so yeah, in the so-called justice system we have, he would go to jail, but trying him in a place where everybody had already decided that he was guilty and then the Supreme Court not allowing a third trial is just garbage. Mm-hmm. It's just, no matter what somebody does, if this is supposed to be a justice system, then we don't let shit like that slide.
You're supposed to have access to something like a fair and unbiased trial, and if that's going to be a requirement for the legal system, then it has to be applied the same every time. So Yount appealed and appealed the sentence, but the Supreme Court denied his requests, in part due to the efforts of Pamela's mother, LaVon Reimer. Yount had 9 pardon hearings, and for each one, LaVon wrote to politicians and led petition drives to ensure his life sentence wasn't shortened. I think that part of what drove LaVon was the pain of losing both of her children. Her son had died in an accident 3 years before Pamela's murder, and her husband also died 10 years after Pamela's murder in 1976, so she lost her whole family. She told a news source, quote, "What he did just didn't end my daughter's life. It ended my life and my husband's life. I have nothing, no children, no grandchildren. No one calls me to say, how are you, Mom? My life is over since then." End quote.
I've got horrible, uncomfortable chills.
Yount was a model prisoner. He played the organ for the choir, he mastered computer programming, and he taught in the prison school. Prison Superintendent Joseph Mazurkiewicz told Unsolved Mysteries, Yount was liked in the prison and would get involved in people's lives in a positive way. He said he was strong-willed and persuasive, and he believed Yount could persuade or manipulate almost anybody. In 1985, Diane was connected with him by a friend of hers who had been visiting him in prison, but couldn't anymore, and Diane felt it would be a natural progression of her letter writing. Diane's sister Faye Snyder explained, quote, "She thought it would be a fulfilling thing to do. She was just always thinking of other people. She really was. She was a people person," end quote. Unsolved Mysteries acquired some of the letters written between Diane and Yount, which were sent to a secret P.O. box rented using her middle and maiden name, Brenda Warner.
I was wondering if those were quotes from real letters.
Mm-hmm. One excerpt read, quote, "Hi, my precious lady. I wanted you to be close to me so much today. I hope my enjoyment and adoration of you is an incentive to be the best you can. You are a classy lady. I miss you and love you, John." End quote. The person they got to narrate the letters in the segment did it so creepy. I was uncomfortable listening to it.
I feel like that might have been intentional.
Could be. But also, I think oftentimes love letters just creep me out.
There is like this fine line between something being romantic and something being either stalkery or cheesy.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's the cheesiness of it that freaks
me out. A little cringy.
Yeah. In February of 1985, Yount wrote, quote, "Be my Valentine, love. You are my heart. I hope more than anything that this is the last Valentine's Day that we will spend apart." End quote.
That definitely speaks to some sort of planning.
It does, but it was also the year that he was appealing for a third trial.
Oh, okay.
And it did wind up getting denied. Mm. Diane continued to visit Yount weekly, even after he was transferred to another prison over 2 hours from her home. A correctional officer, Walter Regal, who was privy to their visits, said that without a doubt, she was his girlfriend. The visits weren't casual. They would embrace and kiss. I don't know if you caught this, but he also called him John Yonts in his interview instead of John Yount. And I was like, come on.
He's probably been guarding thousands of people.
But you're being interviewed. You're being interviewed for an NBC program. I don't think you could make sure you have the name right.
Maybe he was nervous.
Could be. Thank you.
How many times have you mispronounced things when you were nervous?
Yeah, true. It was Regal who saw Diane on the road near where Yount was supposed to be working that day.
I was just tickled that he's like, I was headed to the bowling alley. He's just on his way to go bowl, and isn't that John's girlfriend?
In 1986, Yount had earned the ability to work unsupervised outside of the prison, on a farm detail where he was supposed to cut hay in a field. The day after Yount's escape, troopers arrived at Diane's house asking Chester about her whereabouts. He thought she had gone to Williamsburg, Virginia, and continued to believe that, until the following Tuesday, when she didn't come home. Meanwhile, detectives discovered she had a secret bank account and had withdrawn $7,500 over the last weeks. They also found she had a secret storage facility in Harrisburg where she had hidden an entire car. A whole ass car. In the reenactment, it's a cute little light blue, very 80s hatchback. They also found there had been a 14-minute phone conversation between Diane and Yount the night before the disappearance.
That one could be coincidence because it was just a thing that they did is talk on the phone.
It's true.
But in the context, it probably wasn't.
And that is when they decided to charge her as an accomplice in his escape.
I have to say, when they were talking to her husband, my gut reaction was, were you even paying attention? Like, how could you not notice how big a thing this had become in your wife's life? Mm-hmm. Like, he's like, I thought they were pretty good years.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, I do really feel bad for him mm-hmm. in the end. Yeah, he definitely had some abandonment issues.
Yeah, Chester knew that she spoke of him at home, but nothing else. He knew that she visited him, but that's all. Diane's sister, Faye, also had no idea that they were romantically involved. She said Diane never confided in her about him. When talking about Diane in Unsolved Mysteries, I noticed that Faye used the past tense as if she believed Diane was dead.
Hmm.
It's almost like she would believe that she was dead before believing she would help him escape.
She's the one who was talking about how Diane had a really strong code of ethics.
Yeah, she says, quote, "She was a very moral person, and you just did not do certain things. She had a very strong code of ethics, and certainly helping a prisoner escape was not among them," end quote.
One simply does not wear floor-length white to a wedding. But when you're talking about somebody falling in love with a person they only see one side of, I feel like we're dealing with a much more complex matter of morality.
Hmm.
People can really get blinders.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. One theory of their tandem disappearance was that Yount used Diane to escape by manipulating her emotions and then killed her. Another theory was that they had fallen in love and ran away to start a new life together. That's what Trooper William Madden believed at the time the segment was filmed. Chester, poor Chester, had just celebrated his silver wedding anniversary with Diane. He told Unsolved Mysteries, quote, "Well, my wife has run off with another man. For sure, I do not like it. That's for sure. We were married 25 years, and I thought they were fairly good years. And as I told many people, she didn't just leave me. She left the whole family. I don't think she's alive, because I think if she is, she would contact someone in the family," end quote. I think that's one of the strongest arguments for Diane being dead at this time. It's
hard to believe that somebody could just abandon their children, but we've seen it before with Stephen Hadley,
mm-hmm.
who just up and left his entire family.
Yeah, Diane's children were grown up at this point. I think probably very young adults. But still, it's hard to imagine Diane, who was actively involved in raising them, just leaving. And also, the fact that her overnight bag was still in the trunk of her car, that's pretty weird. Because why would she pack it and just leave it?
Or it was a red herring.
Could be.
I thought it was very weird in the episode how they point out that there was a lot of underwear in the bag. A girl's gotta have her underwear.
Yeah, she doesn't know when she's gonna get her next shower.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, there are a lot of days.
You know, if you're going to go swimming,
every day you need a new pair. Right. And if you go swimming, you need a clean pair of underwear for after.
Yeah.
Maybe some people like to wear multiple pairs of underwear a day just for fun.
It's fine for them. Girl has a right to her underwear. Unlike Chester and Faye, Diane's mother, Nadine, refused to consider that she was dead. But if she was alive, detectives believed she should fear for her life.
I'm very excited to find out what truly happened to her.
F. Cortez Bell III, an assistant district attorney in Pennsylvania, believed Yount's motive for escape was the denial of the third trial.
That seems kind of obvious. You don't need to be a district attorney to think he maybe wasn't happy that he was going to spend the rest of his life in jail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Yount had the advantage of a 3-hour head start on the authorities. The police found the getaway car a month later in Harrisburg, where Diane had stashed the second car. Police received a number of leads throughout the years. There were sightings of Yount in Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Montreal. For a while, investigators thought Yount might be the author of a book called Vanish, Disappearing Through ID Acquisition, written by, get this, Johnny Yount.
That would be a terrible pen name.
Terrible. And they found that Johnny Yount was actually the pen name of a writer in L.A., not our John Yount, so to speak. So that was a dead end. Trooper William Madden, who I mentioned earlier, believed Diane was dead. And he recognized that Yount's skills were versatile. He believed he could manipulate his way into a job in teaching or data processing using any of the skills he picked up during his 20 years in prison. And he was afraid that some officer somewhere would one day pull him over for a traffic violation and wind up shot. But it wasn't a police officer who brought Yount's time on the run to an end. It was a little show called Unsolved Mysteries. Dawn and Cassie Humphreys were at home in Boise, Idaho, watching Unsolved Mysteries when they recognized Diane as a former coworker. They called the FBI, and after a month-long investigation, she and Yount were arrested on June 15th in Coeur d'Alene. Diane and Yount had spent most of their time since the escape in Boise, but had recently moved to a suburb of Coeur d'Alene and rented a basement apartment from Patty Meyer, who lived in the house with her 14-year-old son. Patty told the Collegian that, had she known who they were, she'd have turned them in. Patty said that, since they had moved to Coeur d'Alene, Diane, who was going by the name Catherine or Kathy Kernan, worked while Yount, calling himself Jim Forsgren, tended to the garden. How do you choose the name Forsgren?
Nobody's going to think you're making it up.
Patty also said that she was certain that Diane loved Yount and couldn't imagine how Diane was going to go back to her husband or how Chester could accept her.
I mean, she's not. She's going to go to jail.
Patty said, quote, "I'm just glad that she's going to serve her time and be a better person now," end quote. Diane and Yount's friends in Boise felt quite differently. They arrived in Boise December of 1986. They went straight to the Salvation Army and asked if there were any elderly people they could share Christmas with, and the captain sent them to Unity Church. Yount became active with the choir there, singing and playing the organ. They connected with the community and seemed to fit right in. They found an apartment they rented by a man named John Ross, who said he and his wife were surprised when they met them to hear that they didn't have jobs. Ross said they seemed respectable, nice, friendly, well-educated, excellent people. Yount told them he planned to do odd jobs, and Diane said she had enough money to pay the rent for several months. The couple decided to take a chance on them, and found it paid off. Their tenants made a lot of improvements to the property, painting and doing yard work without expectation of reimbursement. Yount also befriended the landlord's brother, who had recently become disabled due to a stroke. The man slurred his words, and people had a hard time understanding him, so he didn't have a lot of social interaction anymore. Yount took the time to learn how to communicate with him and would take him fishing. He encouraged him to bait his own hook, having noticed that people tended to do everything for him, and quintessentially, let him have the time he needed to complete tasks without getting impatient. According to the man's wife, having the opportunity to succeed at small tasks brightened his spirits, and he began to do more and more for himself. His wife said he was like a new man. The fugitives also befriended a couple in their 70s who were on welfare and struggling to make ends meet. Diane and Yount started going to their house, cooking them dinner, and doing their housework. A friend the reporter interviewed said it really made a difference in their lives. After learning their true identities, their friends in Boise were shocked, but not bitter. Their landlord said if they ever needed a home, they would be welcome back. After their arrest, Diane faced charges of escape, hindering prosecution, and aiding in the consummation of a crime. Her attorney, Terrence McGowan, told the Beaver County Times that she wished she had never met Yount, stating, quote, "She wants to put the whole phase of her life behind her. She looks back now and says, 'How could I have been so stupid?'" End quote.
I find that unbelievable.
Yeah, that she would write to someone for 4 years and visit them in prison and then say...
And run away with them for two years. And honestly, it sounds like they had a really nice 2 years. Sounds like they did a lot, just lived a lot.
Mm-hmm. They really embraced being in a community. McGowan explained Diane's actions by saying that she was going through a difficult time in her life. He said her children had grown up, and she felt they didn't need her anymore. She wasn't getting the attention she needed or wanted at home.
Obviously. Poor Chester.
Poor Chester. And she was attracted to John Yount, in part because he gave her the attention she needed. McGowan said, quote, "The John Yount she knew wasn't the John Yount people in Clearfield County think of," end quote. He also said that if it hadn't been Diane, Yount would have found some other woman to help him. Diane wound up pleading guilty to conspiracy to escape in exchange for dropping the other charges. Her family helped her post $25,000 bail, so she could be home while awaiting sentencing. She faced up to 7 years and a $15,000 fine.
Hold on. Louis Carlucci had a $1,000 bail, and he was sentenced to 4 years for ruining the lives of about 30 women.
And stealing over a million.
I'm not going to say that he ruined their lives, because I'm sure many of them were very...
strong, resilient.
Yes.
Bounced back.
Yes.
Yeah.
But he definitely gave them a bad time.
Uh-huh. He didn't paint his landlord's house and bring food to the elderly.
No, he sure did not. He defrauded the elderly. I mean, I have no evidence about that, but I'm sure.
Yeah, probably. D.A. Ray Gricar told the Philadelphia Daily News that despite her immaculate background, probation wasn't enough punishment for Diane because it would be a, quote, green light for any do-gooder out in the community to take the law into their own hands and decide that if they felt that someone wasn't dangerous, they could turn them loose and there wouldn't be any penalty, end quote. I don't know what perverse view of the world this guy has that he thinks that a bunch of people are going to go try to spring murderers from the can. It's a thing that I think happens in a few Unsolved Mysteries segments, but it's not a thing that a bunch of people are just going to rush out and do if they think they'll only get probation.
People aren't just waiting for a reduced sentence to go start breaking people out of jail.
Right. As a side note, Ray Gricar disappeared in 2005. I happened upon this by random chance. He went for a drive one morning in his red Mini Cooper and was never seen again.
Maybe he assisted in somebody's escape and went off to live happily ever after.
I didn't even consider that. But his car was also found eventually. And there are theories that he was either murdered or died by suicide. It's said that he was acting odd, like kind of absent, before he disappeared. And then they found a county code book on his desk that was open to a page about what happens when a DA can no longer serve. But also, a Hell's Angel was linked to the case and admitted to murdering him. But when they took officers to the supposed burial site, there was nothing there. And so the individual was discredited. So, spooky mystery.
Sounds like there were some skeletons in the closet.
Possibly. If it was murder, though, they think that it would have been someone who was getting payback for prosecuting them. The Philadelphia Daily News reported that Diane showed no emotion as Judge Charles Brown sentenced her to 2 years in prison with 79 days time served. She said she thought the judge was very fair and stated in clear, unwavering voice that she regretted helping Yount escape. She said, quote, "I am greatly saddened and sorry for the pain and suffering I brought on my family and friends. I also regret breaking the law. I know I am solely responsible for what I did," end quote. She was released from jail in 1990 and slipped quietly out of the public eye.
I know she said what she had to in order to get a shorter sentence, but I'd respect her more if she had stuck by her guns.
Sadly, Chester Broadbeck died September 13th, 1995, just 5 years after she was released, at age 54.
Poor Chester.
His headstone bears Diane's name and year of birth, in addition to his own. So I do believe she went back to him, even though she effectively scrubbed herself from the public eye after being released. John Yount pleaded guilty to escape, and a judge added 3 to 7 additional years to his sentence.
To his life sentence.
Yeah. Explaining his motive, he said, quote, "After 20 years, I felt I had paid my debt, and if I was to be able to capture any meaning to the rest of my life, it was necessary," end quote. He said he would trade the rest of his life to relive those 26 months of freedom. As I was researching this case, this write-up kept popping up that was titled In Memory of John Yount. And I was like, that has to be a different Yount. But it was John E. Yount. And I was like, so why would someone be commemorating John Yount? And so I was just like, I'm not going to read that. Nobody wants to know why someone is remembering John Yount, right?
What kind of asshole would be memorializing a murderer?
Precisely. But it kept showing up in all of my searches. And so I was like, okay, if I'm going to do my due diligence, I need to check this out. And what I read stunned me. Back in Huntingdon Prison in central Pennsylvania, Yount joined a lifers group and set out to see how he could better the world from behind bars. According to a write-up by James Kilgore and Teresa Barnes on Yount's prison reform and anti-racist legacy, the lifers were a predominantly African-American group that had held weekly meetings where they would discuss personal responsibility and giving back. They had won the right to run the prison's soda concessions at Huntingdon and made thousands of dollars off the sales, which they would donate to local charities. Yount pushed the group to become involved in prison reform and to bring in speakers on current issues. Building off of his work with the group, Yount began researching activities within the prison system that were unjust, and the legal actions he could take to repair them. Peter Wagner, who wrote the initial In Memory article I saw, credits Yount with being the first to recognize that the way the Census Bureau counted inmates distorted state legislature redistricting. Areas with high prison populations could count inmates as residents, even though they didn't have the right or ability to vote, and use it to gerrymander in legislative districts, unfairly inflating the value of votes in those areas. Plus, Yount recognized a trend of rapidly increasing rates of incarceration, especially within Black, people of color, and other communities who already had a history of being disenfranchised, which meant as voting power increased in gerrymandered districts, it decreased within those communities. He also watched from the inside as sentencing policies became more and more extreme. It became tactful for politicians in prison districts to advocate for longer sentences to keep their supposed resident count high, and their inflated power resulting from gerrymandering gave them the power to enact the policies that they advocated.
That is dirty.
Mm-hmm.
That's infuriating.
Talk about criminal. Due to Yount's work in partnership with lawyers and activists both inside and out of the prison, prison-based gerrymandering became one of the central controversies of the 2010 census, and four states passed legislation to end it. The Census Bureau also changed the way they publish data so that it's easier to identify if an individual is part of a prison population, and it's more difficult for politicians to participate in prison-based gerrymandering. In another case, Yount partnered with other inmates and lawyers to bring about Mixon v. Commonwealth, which challenged the ban on the rights of people in and recently released from prison to vote. Together, they won the right for all people on parole in Pennsylvania to vote. Before, they had to wait 5 years. Considering the disproportionate rate that Black Americans are incarcerated, this kind of change is vital if we're ever going to create an equitable system. He also brought abusive phone practices to light. The DOC, Department of Corrections, required that inmates use a phone company that charged, quote, exorbitant rates and would arbitrarily disconnect calls so that the caller would have to pay more to make the call again.
More trash.
In exchange for the monopoly contract, the company kicked back $3 million a year plus 32 to 40% of the revenue from the calls to the DOC.
And here is a perfect example of why our supposed criminal justice system is absolute garbage.
Mm-hmm. Yount brought this fact before the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission, which condemned the collusion between the company and the DOC, and in 2008 ordered a refund of inappropriate charges. Unfortunately, this gross overcharging is still a problem, and if you hear that and you think, well, people who committed crimes deserve what they get, I'd like to point out that it's not just inmates who have to shoulder these costs, it's their families too. I completely randomly happened upon a 5-minute TED Talk by a woman named Bianca Tylek on this very topic, where she explains that some inmates and their families are charged as much as $1 per minute to talk. She says that 87% of the family that shoulder the burden are women, and because of the history of institutional racism in this country, is frequently Black and brown women. So the DOC and sometimes the government still get kickbacks from these charges. It's a billion-dollar industry. So the DOC and the government are profiting off of Black and brown women who just want to speak to their children or their siblings or partners or friends.
And to that point, it doesn't matter if these people are prisoners. They're still humans.
Yeah.
And isolating a person is cruel and inhuman.
And also, in like 3 minutes, Bianca explains how these practices actually cost the taxpayers money and incentivizes lawmakers to keep people in jail and damages people's chance of success at reentry, because not being connected to family actually decreases success and increases recidivism. When people can't stay connected to their community, they're less likely to succeed.
I am so mad.
I highly recommend watching that video. It's just over 5 minutes, and it will be in the show notes. Bianca Tylek is actually the founder of an organization called Worth Rises that's done a lot of really awesome work towards changing phone policies in prison and also dismantling the industry to end exploitative practices. So she's a bomb-ass lady. But for Yount, it was this phone ordeal. Not the escape, not the fight against gerrymandering, not gaining voting rights, but this success of winning refunds for overcharged communication that got Yount punished. We should all know by now that the prison industrial complex is a for-profit machine that values money over people. Despite not having a single disciplinary infraction in 16 years at Huntington Prison, as punishment for the phones, Yount was transferred to the SGI Green Facility, a remote prison near the West Virginia border, where there were no inmate organizations and it was immensely more difficult for people to visit. Cut off from his lifers group, community, and any outlet to do good in the world, Yount sunk into depression. He had been in good health before he was found in his cell, dead by suicide, on April 26, 2012. The DOC had pushed a human being to die by suicide by taking away all agency, autonomy, and that thing so essential to humans, community. John Yount committed an atrocious act when he murdered Pamela Sue Reimer in 1966, an act that destroyed a young woman and her family and which could never be undone. And as Peter Wagner wrote, he spent the rest of his life trying to prove that he was better than his worst act. Wagner posited that the advancements Yount made for social justice while behind bars showed how wrong it is to assume that a single bad act can define someone forever. I think it's a very uncomfortable idea because of the way we're socialized to view criminality in black and white. It's good or it's bad. It's crime and punishment. But I think the uncomfortable reality is that people can do something absolutely awful and still have ways to contribute positively in the world.
There's no way to make up for doing something so incredibly horrible.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't negate the positive things that he did in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Those positive things don't negate what he did to Pamela either.
Right. I just think this is an example of how people who do something horrible aren't necessarily irredeemable.
You're all about restorative justice. I mean, I know less about it than you, but I am too. But that, I think, is a topic for someone else's podcast.
It is. It's a very uncomfortable thing to think about, I think. It's a very foreign concept. So, the system is overtly cruel and dehumanizing.
And as you already said, for profit.
Mm-hmm. It's like when they say to judge your date not by how they treat you, but how they treat the waiter. It's like, I think it's fair to judge a society based on how they treat the powerless and the vulnerable. and we're not doing great. Snaps. So that's the story. We started with one crime, we went into another, and then we twisted and turned like a water slide into a whole different one. It's more of a crime against humanity as a whole. Thank you so much for listening. If you've listened to this and you still want to connect with us on Instagram, we're at You Solved a Mystery. You can email us at yousolvedamystery@gmail.com. Let's see. What else? Maybe share us with a friend.
You could do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, feel free.
As always, I'm Athena.
And I'm Chandra.
Join us next time for You Solved a Mystery.